Well, good morning and welcome back to the Broadcast Retirement Network. I'm Jeff Snyder, and this is BRN Weekly for Saturday, November 7th, 2020. And our top story today, the Department of Labor issues a final ESG rule. Joining me now to discuss this and more is Preston Rutledge. He is principal and founder of the Rutledge Policy Group. Preston, welcome back to the program. Great to have you here this morning.
Oh, well, thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it a lot. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's always great to talk to you about policy. And, you know, this rule, the Department of Labor ESG rule, this has finally come into final form. So I thought it made sense to catch up with you. So what do you have to tell us?
Well, so when we spoke in September about the ESG proposal, I said that the Department of Labor usually makes changes in a final rule based on the public comments received. And that's exactly what we see in the final rule. The department published the final rule on October 30, and they've definitely made changes based on the public comments. First, though, I'd like to say the final rule does not change the core principle that the DOL has followed in this area, you know, for decades. And we also spoke about that in September. And that core principle is that ERISA does prohibit a fiduciary from investing in a vehicle where the underlying investment strategy of the vehicle is to accept lower returns or increased risk for the purpose of non-financial objectives. But what's changed? So I'd like to mention two things in particular.
Sure.
First, the final rule, unlike the proposal, the final rule does not ban ESG in a qualified default investment alternative. It can be the qualified default investment alternative. We discussed that in September because the public comments had criticized this a lot. Because if a fiduciary has gone through the prudent objective process of selecting an investment and it happens to have ESG factors incorporated, but it still passes that prudent objective analysis, why should it matter if it has ESG factors? There were a lot of comments on this topic, and the DOL responded, and what they're now saying is, in the final rule, they're only saying that a fiduciary is prohibited from using an investment fund as a QDIA if its principal investment strategy involves the use of a non-pecuniary factor. So again, the focus, it isn't that you can't have non-pecuniary factors, ESG factors, if they're non-pecuniary, for example. It's that they can't be the primary focus of the investment. The primary focus has to be on risk return and pecuniary factors, which leads me to the second major thing that I wanted to mention this morning in the final rule.
Sure.
The regulatory text no longer mentions the term ESG. It doesn't mention ESG collectively or E, S, or G individually. And the reason for that, and the DOL explains, is that there's a problem with the generally accepted definition of ESG. There's just not, at this point, a precise or generally accepted definition of what is ESG. I think they've got a good point on that. The policymakers all over the world right now are working on a number of things in ESG, and one of the things they're working on is trying to nail down the definitions. They're also trying to nail down how do you measure the products, how do you measure whether they're accomplishing what they're intended to accomplish. But since there's no hard and fast definition, having ESG embedded in regulatory text was considered inappropriate. So instead of that, the regulatory text refers to pecuniary factors and non-pecuniary factors. And so that's the regulatory standard using those terms. So the bottom line is that financial materiality is still the key. And if ESG funds continue to perform well financially, they will become more common in plan investment lineups.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, I guess it's great in a way that the Department of Labor listened to the comments and tried to embed those thoughts into the final rule. And this seems like, this meaning ESG, seems like a train that has left the station. It is a environment, a market that is continuing to develop and will become more mature. And with that maturity comes data, which you alluded to, that is needed to do measurement and benchmark. And that, of course, will mean that fiduciaries will have more information by which they can make a decision. Is there any chance down the line that the QDIA rules might be revisited at some point, maybe a year from now or some period of time as this market continues to mature?
Well, I'm not sure that it'll be necessary as the market continues to mature and it becomes more obvious and more measurable that a ESG factor is in fact a pecuniary factor, and that's the principal focus of the fund, of the investment fund in question. That should be, under the standard they've announced, an acceptable a factor to be in your QDIA, or an acceptable vehicle as the QDIA. If in practice it becomes obvious that it's not particularly workable, then sure, I can see the Department of Labor wanting to revisit it. The Department of Labor is very practical. They want their rules to work in the real world, and if there's some real world issues down the road. What I don't think you'll see the department departing from, and I think this is true, this is my personal view, regardless of the administration in the future, Democrat or Republican, I don't think the department will depart from that core principle that under ERISA, at least, the ERISA rules of exclusive purpose, duty of loyalty, duty of prudence, under those principles, the fiduciary really does have to put the financial interests of the participants first. But if you can do that with using ESG at the same time, if those are in fact fiduciary, financially material factors, as it seems like they are becoming more and more, then there will not be a conflict between the two. I think that's where the market's headed. I think the market's headed, as I you put it, you may have put it a little differently, but I think what you're saying is the market seems to be moving in the direction where this conflict will become smaller and smaller and might even cease to exist.
Yeah, well, you put it more eloquently than I ever could. Last question, Preston. In terms of, you mentioned new administration, we are kind of still trying to figure out who the president will be. Is it your sense that in a different administration that this rule could be pulled back? I just want to give the audience what could happen, not what will happen, not prognosticate, but does a new administration have the ability to, obviously they're going to have a different Department of Labor secretary, they'll have different appointees, but can they pull the rule back and change the rule to their desired form, or is this final and set in stone and like a commandment?
Well, I think it's not really either one. It will be final before the new administration comes in, whichever administration that is in January of next year, because it was sent to the Federal Register already. And of course, the rule becomes final 60 days after publication in the Federal Register. So it will be a final and effective rule. So you can't, I think you used the phrase pull it back. You can't pull it back if the effective date is already come and gone. What you can't, but it's not locked in stone in particularly either. I mean, that's probably an overstatement, because you can always revisit even a final rule, but you'd have to start over with a new proposed rule. Proposal, notice and comment, read the comments, all of that has to happen. And then you have to have a basis. I mean, you've got to have an economic analysis that shows that the cost-benefit analysis, you have to be able to show that the benefit of the new proposal you're making is benefits the system more than it costs the system as compared to the rule you're replacing. So this will become the new baseline. Right. That is true. It'll be the baseline. If you want to change it, you're going to need something that improves on the system from a cost benefit analysis perspective, and as well as from a regulatory perspective. So I think there might be some challenges there, but it's hard to say. Look, I do think it's very interesting that the rule, by using the phrase, the terms pecuniary and non-pecuniary, they've sort of, you know, removed the sort of the, I don't know, the whatever emotion might surround the phrase ESG by not putting it into the regulation itself. I think that might turn out to be quite significant.
Yeah. Well, I guess we're just going to have to wait and see here. Preston, thanks so much for joining us again on the program. Interesting analysis, and we'll just, I guess, have to see how things kind of play out. Look forward to having you back on again very soon.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. It's always a pleasure. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Preston. And when we come back, we'll take a look at some of our best segments for the week. You're going to want to stay tuned right here on BRN Weekly. Imagine a new television network that will make you richer, healthier, and in control of your financial future. This network is for the policewoman in Nashville, Tennessee, the baker in Dubuque, Iowa, the teacher in Lexington, Kentucky. We want to make the idea of savings and retirement culturally relevant. But what do you see as a defining issue of the midterms? Especially for the smaller businesses, I mean, they are the lifeblood of the American economy. Featuring exclusive interviews, current affairs, and docuseries. 33 years old, you retired early.
The philosophy is money only matters if it helps you live a life that you love.
But you gotta start thinking about retirement as soon as you get in.
The Broadcast Retirement Network will drive very high engagement with premium partnerships. So this isn't retirement and savings for your parents or grandparents. This is for all Americans. And we're gonna change the way you think about money. Welcome to the next frontier of retirement and savings. This is BRN, the Broadcast Retirement Network.
Hi folks, Joe Namath here, and if you're on Medicare, this is important. You're now entitled to eliminate copays and get dental care, dentures, eyeglasses, prescription coverage, in-home aids, unlimited transportation, and home-delivered meals, all at no additional cost. Plus, your zip code may have coverage with the Give Back benefit that adds money back to your Social Security check every month. Look, with the uncertainty of the virus and vaccines, you need to get everything you're entitled to. Here's the bottom line. Call to get significant benefits at no additional cost and see if your zip code has coverage with the Give Back benefit. Millions of people have trusted the Medicare Coverage Helpline. You can too. Call now. It's free.
Call 1-800-924-3920. That's 1-800-924-3920.
Welcome back. On Monday, I sat down with Marielle Shurig to discuss women's financial decision making. Let's take a look.
My role as an advisor really is to help people prioritize their goal and make informed financial choices in their daily lives so they feel empowered to pursue those goals with potentially greater success than they thought possible. I spent my entire career in the financial services industry, and I like to call it the financial advice industry. I've been at UBS for about 10 years now. I was at Morgan Stanley before that in a similar role. And over that time, I've had a lot of opportunity to talk to all types of people every single day about their personal finances and their goals for the future. And a common theme that I've seen time and time again in working with clients is that it's so important, especially for women, to understand their finances. But women are extremely underserved in the financial services industry, and far too many women take a backseat when it comes to long-term financial planning and investing. So I've made it part of my mission over the last few years to really try to help change that narrative So I'm really excited for the opportunity to talk to you about this today and to dig a little bit further. And before I get into that, let me touch on a little bit about the financial services industry, because that also plays a role in financial literacy for women, because there is very little gender diversity in financial services. Only about 15% of all financial advisors are women. And according to the CFP board, only, you know, women only account for about 20% of financial planners. So it's a very male-dominated industry. And research has shown us that, unfortunately, many women are dissatisfied by the lack of attention and understanding that they receive from financial services. And they feel unheard and unseen. And it really does show when you look at the statistics, because about 70% of widowed women actually fire their advisors after their spouse passes. And in addition to that, about 70% of women prefer to work with a female financial advisor and believe that a more customized approach by advisors that really understand a woman's mindset and needs will serve them better. So gender certainly does not determine one's credibility or effectiveness as a financial advisor. There are some fantastic male advisors out there who work very well with women, but having fewer female advisors in the industry does highlight a lack of choice that some female clients will face when seeking help. And it does create blind spots in how the industry meets the needs of these women and provides them with the education that they need to stay on track with their finances. So personally, I'm constantly encouraging younger women to get interested in the industry as a career path. And more than ever before, and I think we're seeing this a lot now with the pandemic, financial advice from professionals who are looking to help and serve in this industry, it's just requiring more and more emotional and empathetic support from advisors. So it's a great business for women to be in. And there's a huge need, especially because women have such unique financial situations and measure financial success much differently than men do. So to answer your question, some of the examples here, really, you know, if a recent PIMCO survey showed that women rank health and wellness on par with longevity, and by contrast, male investors typically prioritize market performance as their primary financial goals. So that's one example of just how different men and women are. And while men and women are both willing to take risk, women are more comfortable taking calculated risks that are based on their certainty of achieving their goals. They just take based approach. And this can also make them less willing to invest in the financial markets. So again, education is really key to overcoming this hurdle. So instead of leaving women with higher cash balances and an overallocation to low risk investments, which can dampen returns over time, financial advisors who take the time to provide comprehensive financial planning explanations can really help women become more comfortable with investing and taking that, you know, appropriate amount of risk is aligned with meeting taking the appropriate amount of risk that's aligned with meeting their goals. Women also lead very different lives than men, right? So women face wage inequality. The gender pay gap compounds over a lifetime. Does impact a woman's ability to build wealth over time. Women also hit their peak earning years earlier than men do. The average age in which annual salaries for women in the US stop growing is typically around their 40s. And for men, it's roughly in their 50s and 60s. Women's pay is also affected by more career breaks. Women take more time off of work for family-related matters, such as raising children or helping with aging parents or relatives, more than men do. And women also tend to keep more of our money in cash and invest less than men, meaning that the money that we do have is growing much slower than men's savings over time. And only about 38% of women currently invest in the financial markets. So women retire on average now with about 2/3 less money than men do. But on the flip side, we live longer than men on average. And so
that's a good thing.
We're we're living longer than you. And so because of that, you know, we need our money to stretch over a longer Absolutely. Period of time. And, you know, in fact, statistics show that 8 out of 10 women will end up solely responsible for their own financial well-being at some point later on in their lives. So this is really a situation that's unique to women and that most women will face.
And this week, I also spoke with Retirement Clearinghouse's Spencer Williams and Alight Solutions' Rob Austin about auto portability for small 401k balances. Let's take a look.
So let me just kind of give a little bit of prevalence. Let's kind of talk about some of the findings that we have through all of the research that we've done here at Alight. So we have a report, we call it our Trends and Experience and Defined Contribution Plans that we've done for several years. And what we found was with automatic enrollment, sort of in the wake of PPA, it was about 60% of employers had this. But over the last few years now, Jeff, it's almost 3/4 of employers, large employers particularly, have automatic enrollment. And I think some of it's because the dialogue has shifted from why should we add this to how can we justify not having it? And a lot of that justification comes down to the data that we see. Plans that have automatic enrollment have much higher participation rates than those that don't. And in fact, when we look at this, plans that have automatic enrollment have an average participation rate of 87%. Plans that don't have automatic enrollment, average participation rate, 62%. That's a 25 percentage point gulf that's just due to automatic enrollment. So I think a lot of people are saying, does automatic enrollment work? Yes, absolutely. 25 percentage points higher from the average participation rate. So let's look now at automatic contribution escalation. Again, it's about 3/4 of employers have automatic contribution escalation. And I think here's a really good proof point to say, why does that work? If I look at 2020, and I even concentrate down in that first quarter of 2020, when Wall Street was crumbling and 401k account balances were just tumbling, we still saw almost 20% of people increase their contribution rate to the 401k. This is when people were pulling back on other expenditures, but they were increasing their 401k contributions. Why is that? Let me pop the hood. We know these auto features work, and I think the lesson that a lot of plan sponsors have is if there are automatic features that are going to improve people's accounts, by all means, let's go ahead and add them.
Great. So yeah, let's start with the prime fiduciary, who's the plan sponsor, and you say, so what's in it for them in terms of auto portability? Well, first of all, a higher bar is set when you talk about, hey, there's an ability, a capability in the market to retain these savings. But let's drill down into that, you know, peel the cover off, as they say. One, they have a small account problem too, okay, plan sponsors. And when we talk to them, most of them don't like the fact that they distribute these accounts out to, you know, an IRA, and they sort of get lost, orphaned, yep, stranded, you know, all of those words. But let's flip that around, because I think this is the, you know, the dawning that is starting to happen. It's early days yet, Jeff, but think about all your new hires. Okay, so you're an employer. You just hired someone. The odds are pretty good they came from somewhere else, and the odds are very high that they had a 401k there. Now, wouldn't you want them to bring that money into your plan for multiple reasons, okay? You know, one, average account balances. So you get a pricing advantage if you have more money in the plan. That's just how the system works. Two, financial wellness programs. How, as you were intimating a second ago, Jeff, how are you going to deliver a financial wellness program on somebody who just started contributing to your plan at $100 a week? Okay, it's crazy, right? But if they bring in their prior balance, all of a sudden the picture gets full. So I think from a fiduciary perspective, you know, particularly when you think about the guardrails that the Department of Labor has put around auto portability to ensure consumer protections, it is kind of a no-brainer for a plan sponsor. I'm going to do a throwback analogy for you, Jeff. Okay, okay. Throwback analogy was when the railroads first started getting built, right? So the first thing that had to happen is we had to lay tracks. That's the infrastructure that you're referring to. Now, here's the funny thing. Alight has 185 plan sponsors and 5 million participants. And I promise you that when we turn this on at Alight here come next spring, that there will be traffic across those rail lines just within Alight, because you have to, it's not like Alight is actually the operative engine. It's all the clients. Those clients are actually where the participants are changing jobs. Okay, so then the importance of Alight is just beyond comprehension. They're like the, you know, the stake in the ground, the central rail station, and from there we're able to build off additional spokes of rail lines. So when we connect to Vanguard or we connect to Fidelity, all of a sudden we get sort of geometric increase in traffic. So you get the main rail station, that's Alight. I congratulate them for having the courage and the insight, you know, to adopt first, you know, and from there it just gets better as you expand the network.
And that wraps up this episode of BRN Weekly. Have a topic of interest or someone you think we should talk to? Drop us a line. And don't forget, for all the news in retirement, markets, technology, personal finance, so much more, check out today's edition of our newsletter, The Morning Pulse. Don't forget, we're back again tomorrow with members of the media, academia, and financial services as we analyze all the news in retirement, markets, technology, personal finance, so much more. You're not going to want to miss BRN Sunday. So until then, I'm Jeff Snyder. Stay safe, keep on saving, and don't forget, roll with the changes.
Are you being audited and do you owe the IRS $10,000 or more in back taxes? Is the IRS threatening to take more of your money? Don't fight the IRS alone. The Tax Doctor is here to help you negotiate your tax bill and reduce your stress. The IRS can freeze your assets and seize your bank accounts, but you can stop these IRS actions. The Tax Doctor will work with you using our years of experience to represent your case to help you get the best resolution under the IRS guidelines. Help is here to deal with the IRS to reduce your stress. We've handled thousands of cases, so we know what we're doing. If you owe $10,000 or more in back taxes, do not call the IRS alone. Call a Tax Doctor now for a tax emergency analysis.
Call 800-224-6439.